exploring the Columbus Quincentenary in the light of the Gospel of Mark. I've called this one, You Feed Them, The Wilderness Feedings and the Economics of Sharing. This one will have to do with some of the economic implications of the Quincentenary, and we'll look at the two Markan texts in which the crowds are fed by Jesus. Just by way of maybe a brief kind of review of what we've talked about in past sessions, I would say that we're not looking critically at the Columbus story or the Quincentenary simply to criticize Columbus. We're doing it for many other reasons, one of which is to uncover and understand some of the belief systems, cultural myths as we're calling them, that enabled the conquest of the Americas. Because by uncovering those, we can see them as they are manifest in our life today, and we can be able to see how some of those same myths are underlying the arms race, homelessness, poverty, unjust foreign policy, current issues of injustice in contemporary society. I'd say another of the reasons that we look at the Quincentenary is to assess and critique the accuracy of the Columbus stories. The story of the Europeans coming to the Americas has been mistold, many, many voices have been left out, and the story as we get it through history helps shape the way we relate to people today, and we base relationships to nations and to people on false stories in many ways. Really quickly, some of what we looked at in the last session, in the last two sessions, by looking at art and by looking at children's textbooks, were some of the worldviews that we saw underlying the conquest of the Americas. Might is right. The right might, in other words, power, gives the right to subjugate or to enslave. That the Europeans were God-chosen people, number two. Number three, that people of color needed European or need European Christianity. Four, white male people are depicted as intelligent, articulate, competent. People of color, female people aren't. In some ways, that people of color are less human. Six, that the purpose of people, as we saw it in Columbus Day and we see in some ways today, is profit for others. And seventh, another myth that was named was that we're taught to listen to the perspective of the conquerors and not the conquered. I brought up a quote by Plato that I love. The people who tell the stories rule society. And I found that to be an interesting way of looking at the power of the way we learn the Columbus story. Then the other statement in review of the past four sessions is that we are looking at four different journeys in this series. One is the journey of the Europeans to the Americas. Another is our own personal cultural journeys. Another is the discipleship journey in the day of Jesus. And another is our discipleship journeys today, our journeys as followers of Christ. So with that, as a brief kind of synopsis of some of the past sessions, I'd like to open with a reading. We have opened each session with at least a brief reading that is the voices of Native American people. I think it would be somewhat arrogant to talk about the Quincentenary without listening to the voices of Native people. This is actually a text about the Taino Indians, the Native people who lived on the islands on the island that is now Santo Domingo in Haiti and the island of Cuba, which were the islands, some of the islands first arrived at by Columbus. This reading is actually found in this book, which is an excellent book that you can find in the Resource Center here at Holden. I would ask that you simply listen carefully and try to imagine the people that you hear about in this reading. It's by Jose Barriero, and it's entitled A Note on the Tainos, Whither Progress. The Tainos had many cosmological stories and fundamental cultural principles. High among these was the organization of the people to produce food and the value of feeding everyone in each community. Whatever else can be said of their ancient way of life, it contrasted starkly with the Spanish idea of economics in 1500. As Las Casas, (Las Casas, Bartolomé de Las Casas) was the first priest ordained to priesthood in the Americas, and he was a fervent, he fervently cried out against the subjugation of the native people. End parentheses. As Las Casas and others have attested, the migrations to America occurred because no such principle was at work in Europe during the same and later times. Even the earliest encounters between Iberians and Tainos provide evidence of the fundamental American indigenous thinking about this human value, which is found throughout the continent and continues to be one of the contrapuntal arguments between the American Indian civilization and European civilization. And again, this fundamental principle that he's talking about is the feeding of all people. By all descriptions, Taino life and culture at contact was uniquely adapted to its environment. Population estimates vary greatly, but put the number of inhabitants in Española at approximately 500,000 to 7 million. Estimates for Cuba vary from 120 to 200,000, with newer estimates pushing that number up. Whether one takes the low or the high estimates, early descriptions of Taino life at contact tell of high concentrations, strings of 100 or more villages of 500 to 1,000 people. These concentrations of people in coastal areas and river deltas were apparently well-fed in a natural harvesting and agricultural production system whose primary value was that of all the people had the right to eat. Everyone in the society had a food or other goods-producing task. Even the highly esteemed medicine people, who were often seen to plant, hunt, and fish among their people. In the Taino culture, as with most natural world cultures of the Americas, the concept was still fresh in the human memory that the primary bounties of the earth, particularly those that humans eat, are to be produced in cooperation and are to be shared. Comparison of the lifestyle described by the early chroniclers and today's standard of living in Haiti and the Dominican Republic for the majority of the population, as well as the ecological degradation caused by extensive deforestation, indicates that the island and its human citizens were better fed, healthier, and better governed by the Taino's so-called primitive methods than by the modern populations of the same island. You may know, again parenthetically, that the island or the country of Haiti is the poorest, if one of the poorest, if not the poorest, countries in the Western Hemisphere. And Haiti, again, is on the island that we're talking about. Like all American indigenous people, the Taino had an involved economic life. They could trade throughout the Caribbean and had systems of governance and beliefs that maintained harmony between Europe, between human and natural environments. The Tainos enjoyed a peaceful way of life that modern anthropologists now called ecosystemic. In the wake of recent scientific revelations about the cost of high-impact technologies upon the natural world, a culture such as the Taino that could feed several million people without permanently wearing down its surroundings might command higher respect. As can be seen throughout the Americas, American indigenous peoples and their systems of life have been denigrated and misperceived. Most persistent of European ethnocentrisms towards Indians is the concept of the primitive, always buttressed with the rule of least advanced to most advanced, imposed by the prism of Western civilization. The more primitive a people, the lower the place they are assigned in the scale of civilization. For those who came in late, the earlier part of that reading just described the high concentration of people, of the Taino people on the islands, and the fact that a principal value of life was that all people take part in the production of the goods necessary for life and that all people be fed. Any comments just in brief response to that reading? I'd like to take us now to, having read about that image of life before the Europeans arrived on the islands on which they first arrived, look for a moment at today. And as we did in the first session, we named some of what we saw belief systems, assumptions about life that enabled the conquest of the Americas to happen. And I use that term because it's the term that I hear most used by indigenous people in this country in talking about the period from 1492 until today. Take a look at some of those. We could maybe even start with the top two, or look at all of them, and name, if you will, ways in which you might see those same myths or those same belief systems manifest today in today's world. And I'll just take a few comments by brainstorm.
I suppose today we don't look so much as God's chosen people as the Europeans, but as Americans of European descent.
Interesting. That's a good point. One of the ones that seems really strong to me is the concept, actually it's not even up there, but the concept of the right, or maybe it is the first one, might makes right, the right to land or the right to resources. To me, that is one of the myths that enabled the conquest that is also enormously present today. I live in Washington, D.C., and I see neighborhood after neighborhood being bought by people from outside who have money, who jack up the rents, and the poor people are forced out. And the poor people often are forced out onto the streets because there is no housing that they can then afford. And to me, that's another example of somehow those with power, and in this case economic power, have the right. It's not questioned that they have the right to buy those properties in the inner city and gentrify them, as the term is, and people then lose their livelihoods. It seems to me that there is some parallel between that and the parallel being grounded in an assumption that was a part of the worldview of that day and is a part of our worldview today.
The thing that occurs to me is that, these Indians were living together in a community that worked well, and they took care of their people. And then the Christian community comes in and tears it all down, and our society, we still don't take care of our people. It just seems real ironic that we think that God is on our side when they seem to have a better concept of this compassion and caring than we do, even now.
Well, that's a good point, and one of the things that you bring up in that about the assumption that God is on our side. And I would say that there's another real dangerous one. And to me, these are so important because I firmly believe that we run our society and our lives in many cases on beliefs that we don't question and that we don't know that we have. But to say that God is on our side, some of the places that I've seen that recently are...
The Gulf War.
The Gulf War. Say more.
Grenada.
Oh, Grenada. Good point. That language was used, I'm sure, with Grenada. Another is clearly El Salvador, naming the rebels in El Salvador as heathens and as in some cases representatives of the devil, and therefore it's okay to kill them.
Somehow communism works in there too. Bad guys are always a communist, and that's not quite the same as God, but it's, I don't know, some people, God and country kind of a deal. Sort of seems like the same.
Yes.
I think there's a real priority given to English. We do have a wonderful language, but...
Interesting,
and
right.
And we insist that everyone in the world learn English. Certainly our schools don't teach the kids to speak something else. They're supposed to come here and learn English.
Interesting.
So I think that's changed radically, though, because when our first European immigrations came to the United States, there was this real struggle with learning the dominant language here. And I mean, it would have been fun to find out if it really was a dominant language at any given point. But that is not the case now, and that's kind of ripping our, at least the Western United States is having real problems. We have laws passed to say that English is the official language.
And maybe that is in some ways related to God being on our side. In some way, maybe we sort of assume that, like on our dollars, it says, "In God we trust," and that English is that Jesus spoke English somehow. Walt.
This is just a kind of another idea, but I think fits with that. I have the sense that those people who feel that they are superior also end up hoarding. I'm thinking of this natural premise that all people should be equal. But I find that when people think that they are superior, surrounded by inferior, then they presume that the inferior are going to try to take what the superior has, and therefore they hoard rather than share.
Good point.
And think that they're right to do that because they're sure that the others are just going to bust in their doors any minute now and take what's
good point. And again, there's the assumption of the right to those things to have. Another,
The epitome of that, Walt, was during the, what was the 50s, where we were, or 60s, we were building bomb shelters.
Exactly.
And then the whole idea was that you had the right to protect what was yours, and you had guns out there. I didn't know anybody that really had one, but there was a lot of focus on that. You know, you had stockpiles of food, and you were going to kill anybody that tried to take anything away from you.
I'll add a real quick story to that. This is, it seems to me, an example of that hoarding and also the superiority. Some friends of ours went into a store in Evansville, went to the back of the store. The clerk up front had at least three people who were paying bills. The cash register was open, but the clerk went back to pursue my friends in the back, said, "Can I help you?" They said, "No, we're just looking." She lingered with those two as long as they were in the store. But leaving the cash register open up in the front. And the only difference, of course, is that those two were black, which, in fact, are the parents of these boys that are singing. This is a common thing. She presumed that the whites of the cash register were morally trustworthy, whereas the blacks who were in the back of the store were morally untrustworthy, and she hovered without any knowledge of what she was doing. Here is this fear that you must hoard your things because those who are less than you will steal. In fact, it was a store with picture frames in it, so I guess she thought they could steal her picture frames.
So that's really a good example of, again, to use the term myth, of a myth that says that somehow white people are better than. And that was clearly, in the time of Columbus, that was clearly an enabling myth.
And every black person has countless such stories from every year of their life here.
Yeah.
And I suspect it's not just black people, but any person of color, and for that matter, people with handicapping conditions. One of my best friends is a Japanese midget, and she has wonderful stories. Well, they aren't wonderful, really. They're tragic stories, but she has quite a few stories of the way that she's treated, because she's about 4'2", and she's Japanese.
So you're right. It's not extended simply to African-American people. It's extended to many, many people who are, for reason of color or economic class or sexual preference or other reasons, marginalized in our society. Yes, Barbara.
Oh, I was just thinking, when you were talking about all people of color maybe perhaps have a reputation of not being as whole. In our area where there are lots of Asian individuals, a lot of people really say that the Asian families are very industrious and very good business people, and that the children are very good students. But a parallel to that is that people are also, I hear people who are also very angry that these industrious people are in our space, opening their shops, and being successful. So there's something, there's some kind of acknowledgement of worth of the Asian
That's interesting.
In our community, but there's also a feeling that they don't have the right to be there, and that probably
they don't have the right to come in and work hard and pursue the American dream because they do too well.
Right. So there's a knowledge of succeeding. There's that permission to act worthy, and I think that's what I see in that area.
And that's a terrific example again of the issue of the right to resources, that the people, the white people who are there already have the right, but somehow the Asian people coming in don't. Yes?
I come from the Midwest and agricultural area, and right now we have Mennonite farmers from the East moving into our area. You see the same issues. They're coming in, they're buying farms that we could buy, and you see all kinds of contradictions. You see Roman Catholic farmers whose kids all went to parochial schools saying they're going to ruin our schools because they'll have their own schools, they won't support the public schools, and it's interesting how in a given area, you can have this conflict, no matter what group it is. It isn't always people of color, it's just people that are from somewhere else. And they're very willing to invest their capital, maybe at a greater rate, to help their youngsters than the local people are.
Another good example. Yeah. Bruce?
I think there's two things that I think apply to what you and what Barbara said. Mm-hmm. I think there's an arrogance of particular that comes out of, that I sense comes out of the European invasion of mm-hmm. the Americas that relates to this. Mm-hmm. And out of that arrogance, though, that there's this tailing thing called fear, mm-hmm. fear of things that are different, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and an unwillingness to look at the other, at the gifts that other mm-hmm. cultures can come, because of that arrogance and that mm-hmm. sense that what we have mm-hmm. is somehow God-given, and that it's a very destructive mm-hmm. thing. Mm-hmm.
It relates very well to what Walt said, too, about hoarding.
Very much so.
And I think, too, once you get, if you have just a few of them, whatever mm-hmm. they are, it's one thing. When you have a large group, it's much more threatening. Mm-hmm. Our school, the school my son goes to, recently, back around sometime after Christmas, had a new family move in from Russia, mm-hmm. from Moscow. Mm-hmm. And this one family was overwhelmed with, everyone was so happy to help them, and they gave them mm-hmm. furnishings and clothing. But it's one family mm-hmm. with three mm-hmm. kids. Mm-hmm. And I wondered at the time, and still I'm kind of curious, if suddenly a lot of people from mm-hmm. Moscow move into our mm-hmm. area, mm-hmm. if the same reception will be there.
Sure. And again, one more here. Yes.
Well, excuse me, there always has to be a great dissenter, albeit. Mm-hmm. You look at the history of the blacks, mm-hmm. it's a matriarch society. Mm-hmm. And this day and age, the blacks, mm-hmm. their greatest, their worst problem mm-hmm. is they feel that they're discriminated against, and to the point they are. But when you look at, watch TV and everything, and see how many people have done a tremendous thing when they take care of themselves and pull themselves up. But you look at all of the athletes, and then the people in movies and so on and so forth, and cultural things, they're doing a great job.
I think it's important to see that, and then I think it's also important at the same time to see the many conditions that still work against the majority of African American people having an equal right to life in this country. At the same time that we acknowledge and are, you know, pleased with and grateful for the fact that doors are opening and that many are gaining equal access to the privileges of our society. One more comment, and then I want to move us on, maybe since he hasn't spoken yet. Yes.
I was just going to say, I spent the last 3 weeks working in Tacoma with black people and Cambodians and Vietnamese mm-hmm. and white people. They're all in a low-income housing area. And one thing that I noticed is, and I may not be at the level everybody's speaking here, so I may be off base, but I see that the privileges are offered, but the thing is that it's not. It doesn't always seem racial to me.
Say more.
It seems more class. Social, you know, class.
And when you say it, what do you mean by it?
I mean, I think the opportunities are there, but I mean, I don't think that everybody necessarily wants to live within the standards of, or this idea that capitalism and buying your land and so forth mm-hmm. is what they should have to do in order to live in this mm-hmm. society, you know? And so they remain poor, regardless of whether they're black or white or, you know, any other.
I might just offer one response to that. I, you know, having worked with many different people who are poor in many different areas, I've never known people who don't want adequate food and someplace to live and food and education for their kids. But I also think there are many, many realities that enable certain individuals to make it, you know, in a marginalized culture, but that prohibit large groups of people to make it, and that we sometimes aren't aware of those factors. But I'm not sure what you were saying. I was basically responding to not the comment of them not wanting certain privileges, and I've just never encountered people who don't want some of the basics of life.
I guess I'm not saying not want. Uh-huh. I'm not quite sure what I'm saying. Yeah, so, here's a guy to think about it, maybe I'll...
That's great, because every one of these sessions should be the beginning of conversation, so...
May I say just one thing?
Yes.
I think maybe there are those who, to reply to this young man's statement, there are those who want food, clothing, and shelter, and they're happy with that. They don't want lots of the worldly goods. They, as long as they have the necessities, they're happy, and education for their children.
I guess what I would say to that is our biggest task in response to that is to listen. It's to hear people who are different from us, so that rather than presuming to know what they want, we can begin to learn from them what they want. And so I rather than even responding, I would say that the task before us all is to multiply by hundreds of times our willingness to hear people who are different from us by reading poetry, by reading literature, by listening, by going to churches of people who are different from us, so that we can begin to get a glimpse rather than presume to know. And I speak that to myself also. Yes. I would also say one other thing, and that is that I know that that it's easy for some people, including myself, to come off as terribly critical of our own history and our own people. And to me, the reason to be critical is to see what is and what is wrong so that we can change it, to acknowledge what is wrong so that we can build a better future. It's not to harangue and shebang about what's been wrong and what is wrong, but it's simply to build a more decent, a more humane, a more just, a more honest picture of reality and future for all. So I must say that rather than to sound like the reason for discussion is simply to criticize.
And you mean not to toss out everything, but instead to take a critical look and say, what are we going to keep and what are we going to change?
Yes.
Instead of just tossing it all out and saying we're
sure.
going to start at the beginning.
Sure. Like, sure. Sure. And to open ourselves up, terrifying as it is, to open ourselves up to the idea that maybe the way we believe and the way we see and the way we live does have inherent in it some terrible roots of injustice and oppression of others, and that that's a frightening thing to do, and then make roads to change. Yes.
In, well, the state of Washington, I'm sure it's a federal thing. If you are a governor, you can buy a piece of property or something, 3% interest. If I were to buy or borrow money to buy it, it would cost me 7 to 9. And they're encouraged, and they do take advantage of that. That's the reason that, like the Asians, all of them are buying mom and pop groceries. So they're making them pay, because the whole family gets in there and works. And this is one of the things that the black are going to have to wake up and buy. Their opportunity is there, but it's up to you. Nobody can do it for you. How many of people up here have you worked with black people? You probably won't agree with me, but most of them feel sorry for themselves. And this is a sickness. And it's affected every one of us. I've had it myself too, but you know, after a night or two, I get over that sickness. But I think this is a problem with the black people. They feel sorry for themselves, and they're going to have to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps.
I think I'd like to move us on in the discussion, but I'd also like to say that I see a danger in whenever we think about one group of people having a particular characteristic. Like if we think that all black people think a certain way, it would be like saying that all white people think a certain way. And that can be very destructive, because as we all know, we think and live in many, many different ways. So I would just pull that out as a cautionary note in response to that. I would like us to, you know, having had this brief discussion of some of the myths underlying the conquest and some of them underlying economic injustice today, I'd like to way back in history and move to the time of Jesus. And in this series of reflections, we've been using the book of Mark principally. And all of us, I believe, are familiar with the texts in which Jesus feeds the crowds, the masses. We have three people who will do a dramatic reading of that. What I'd like you to do is maybe even close your eyes and listen and try to imagine yourselves in the setting where this is taking place. And then we'll talk about that a little bit. We have a narrator who is Walt. We have Jesus, who is right here with her hands raised. And then we have the disciples, who is right here. And let me ask also that, try to be the disciples in this. Imagine yourselves to be amongst the disciples as this reading is going on, and think how you feel and what your experience is of these incidents. We'll start with Jesus feeding the 5,000, which is in Mark 6, 31 to 44.
Jesus said to them,
"Come by yourselves to an out-of-the-way place and rest a little."
People were coming and going in great numbers, making it impossible for them to so much as eat. So Jesus and the apostles went off in the boat by themselves to a deserted place. People saw them leaving, and many got to know about it. People from all the towns hastened on foot to the place, arriving ahead of them. Upon disembarking, Jesus saw a vast crowd. He pitied them, for they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them at great length. It was now getting late, and his disciples came to him with a suggestion.
"This is a deserted place, and it's already late. Why do you not dismiss them so that they can go to the crossroads and villages around here and buy themselves something to eat?"
"You give them something to eat.
Are we to go and spend 200 days' wages for bread to feed them?"
"How many loaves have you? Go and see."
When they learned the number, they answered,
5 loaves and 2 fish."
He told them to make the people sit down on the green grass in groups or parties. The people took their places in hundreds and fifties, neatly arranged like flower beds. Then taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, Jesus raised his eyes to heaven, pronounced a blessing, broke the loaves, and gave them to the disciples to distribute. He divided the 2 fish among all of them, and they ate until they had their fill. They gathered up enough leftovers to fill 12 baskets besides what remained of the fish. Those who had eaten the loaves numbered 5,000.
Remain in your role as the disciples and move to Jesus feeding the 4,000, which is in Mark 8.
At about that time, another large crowd assembled, and they were without anything to eat. He called the disciples over to him, and he said,
"My heart is moved with pity for the crowd. But now they have been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way. Some of them have come a great distance."
His disciples replied,
"How can anyone give these people sufficient bread in this deserted spot?"
Still he asked them,
"How many loaves do you have?"
7.
Then he directed the crowd to take their places on the ground. Taking the 7 loaves, he gave thanks and broke them, and gave them to his disciples to distribute. And they handed them out to the crowd. They also had a few small fish. Asking a blessing on the fish, he told them to distribute these also. The people in the crowd ate until they had their fill. Then they gathered up 7 wicker baskets of leftovers. Those who had eaten numbered about 4,000.
How How do you think the disciples might have felt when Jesus said, you give them something to eat?
Inadequate.
Yeah, but they did it. They didn't say, come on, Jesus, be real. They did it. They said, well, this is what we got, and they at least seemed to have some grudging trust that...
They might have. It just didn't get recorded.
Yeah. Although it does say, after he first said that, they said, are we to go and spend 200 days' wages for bread to feed them? So, I mean, I would say, yes, they did it, but they also raised some degree of astonishment or protest on some level.
Huh. I always felt they were sort of exasperated. Yeah. He wasn't doing what they wanted him to do.
Where do you think the food came from?
I've heard a sermon preached on this where it was describing a miracle of sharing, mm-hmm. where when we baskets were brought by the disciples, and they started distributing them. People who maybe had one loaf hidden mm-hmm. there started sharing with their neighbors, mm-hmm. and everyone started sharing. It became mm-hmm. this incredible mm-hmm. sharing process. Mm-hmm. So that's just one person's interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Which isn't any less a miracle.
Right.
Mm-hmm. No less a miracle, maybe more instructive. Mm-hmm. The normal interpretation lays it on the feeding on the miraculous power of God to produce food, and the interpretation that you just brought forth is more instructive to us as disciples, I would think.
Huh. One of the things that just crossed my mind, I've never thought of it mm-hmm. this way before, but sometimes, at least when I read the Bible, mm-hmm. I always think, well, these are the things that are happening so that I can kind of think about them and learn from them now, mm-hmm. as mm-hmm. opposed to when they happen, maybe the message, the primary message of this was the individual message of the people, the 4,000 and 5,000 people who were there, mm-hmm. and that we just have an opportunity to glimpse mm-hmm. at it because mm-hmm. it's been recorded. Mm-hmm. And so the concept, mm-hmm. that's the first time I've heard that interpretation, the concept mm-hmm. of the miracle of sharing. Mm-hmm. That there mm-hmm. were other pieces out there, but people were hoarding. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's some... Mm-hmm. And that it was a gift to the people that were there, mm-hmm. and that's it.
That interpretation maybe points to a different vision of economic order between Jesus and his disciples. His disciples' vision was obviously that the people should go out and get their own food and come back. And Jesus was somehow that the people had enough and could share it. Yeah. Other thoughts about that text? Bruce.
Well, I just another thought that comes mm-hmm. to me. One of the things I think in terms of people who are poor mm-hmm. share much better than people who have lots. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. and so maybe that's a piece of mm-hmm. it as well. Mm-hmm.
I wonder why.
I don't
They know the need.
There's mm-hmm. no barriers.
Well, when you're closer to that, you mm-hmm. know mm-hmm. what it's like. Mm-hmm.
But the text says that Jesus took the loaves mm-hmm. and broke them and distributed them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's not the same as saying Jesus, he did that thing, mm-hmm. and there mm-hmm. were the loaves going out and being distributed. That's different from loaves coming out from people's clothes, too. I don't know why it couldn't yeah. be a miracle.
And I don't think we're saying it couldn't be. I was going to suggest an interpretation similar to the one which you raised, but I don't think it's exclusive at all of miracle, because in the context of food so hoarded that it's not even seen, to have food come forth and be shared, I would see as miraculous as another form of miracle. In other words, it doesn't take the power out of the miraculous power out of the story. It's interesting to notice that in there are two stories of the feeding. We read both of them, and in each of the cycles of Jesus' ministry in the Gospel of Mark, one cycle in Jewish territory and the other in Gentile territory, both of those cycles end with the feedings. And before the feeding, it says that Jesus had compassion for the people, and the word compassion is a powerful word. It literally means to be torn in the guts, to be torn in the guts for these people. And as Marcus pointed out a couple days ago in Bible study, compassion means it's something that happens below the head, a profound feeling of grieving with or rejoicing with the other. But in each one, Jesus had compassion for the crowds. And in the first story, you know, the disciples come to him and say the people need food, and Jesus says, "You feed them." And I think that it's interesting to note how their response is indicative of their relying on the known economic order, the known economic assumptions about life, that the people would then go out and buy their own food in the villages. But Jesus somehow has a different idea of economic reality, or a different idea of distribution of resources. Jesus says, Jesus in this interpretation somehow knows that it's possible for people to share and to equally distribute what is there. And he says to feed them, and they begin to feed them, and the food comes forth and is produced by people. To me, there's a hint in that of a very, very subtle and clever and beautiful and powerful overturning of economic assumptions, perhaps the economic assumptions that we have today, the assumptions that you brought up, Walt, that are somehow prevalent, that if we have, and if we have more than others have, and I don't remember, I think it was you that brought that up too, that we then hoard it and keep it. Ruth?
No, Carol.
Carol, I'm sorry.
It just suddenly occurred to me, I was trying to work on another image up there about technology as being superior. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that one of the things our technology has done is allowed us a better way of hoarding.
A better way of hoarding.
Oh, dear. I mean, so for instance, I spent 2 years in New Guinea, and if you have a meal, you eat it all, and everybody comes in, you share it. There's no refrigerators. So and the food goes rotten if you. And so there's a sense in which when refrigerators come in, there'll probably be a little bit more hoarding than we're really good at hoarding.
And we can see that individually, and we can see that societally in terms of the, what are we, 6% of the world's population using 60% of the world's resources. And that statistic in itself says a huge thing as Christians. I mean, if we weren't people of faith, then it wouldn't necessarily say so much. But as Christians, and as Christians who read about the feedings, and as Christians who live in a world of tremendous poverty, then that statistic says a lot. And I see this feeding story as tremendously instructive to us. Let's carry on with the feeding story a little bit. Let me read it again, and from a slightly different way. And take it as a brief meditation. Close your eyes, and with eyes closed and with bodies relaxed, take a moment to listen to this story again. I do invite you to relax, become aware of your breathing, let go of all responsibilities except one, listen with the ears of imagination, see with your inward eye. Be in that place in the wilderness, that barren, rocky place by the sea, which is almost a natural theater. You are one of the disciples, and you have been very busy for weeks. Much has been needed these days to keep the community going, keeping track of money, food and resources, transportation, lodging, contacts in various communities, crowd control, and most of all, staying out of the hands of the authorities. And here in the wilderness with all these people, the problems just multiply. Where have they all come from, you wonder? Jesus has been teaching for 3 days. He can see that many are dirt poor, hungry, a long way from home. He comes to you and asks what resources we have. A few fish and some bread, you say, never dreaming that he thinks this can make a difference. A few fish and some bread. You feed them, Jesus says. We as disciples experience a range of emotions at this idealism, from shock to wearied exasperation to skepticism to perhaps a seed of wonder. We are, after all, pragmatic. We cannot avoid the huge gap between our resources and the immense need around us. Jesus proceeds without approval or agreement. He blesses those few loaves, and he blesses the groups of men and women and children. There is a long moment when no sound is heard anywhere in the crowd. All eyes are riveted on the few fish and the bread that has been put forward. Finally, a woman slowly rises and places a half loaf and one small fish beside the other food. She has offered up the little that kept her family from desperate hunger on the morrow. She has taken what little security she had and has given it towards something that has not yet happened. It is an act of faith. We watch now as one, two, and now five rise and move forward, drawing bits of food from their sleeves, from inside cloaks and sacks. They come and place the food in growing piles. We watch in astonishment, for in that one moment, this vast crowd becomes a community. Remain a moment now with your eyes closed. Come from that place in the wilderness and move to another wilderness. Move forward in time to today. Imagine some of the marginalized about whom we spoke earlier. Perhaps they are the homeless on the streets of your city. Perhaps they are those being shoved from their lands or from their homes. Perhaps they are migrants earning not enough to feed their families. Perhaps they are victims of wars that we have waged. Imagine yourself among them. Imagine Jesus with you. Imagine you point out their need to Jesus, expecting Jesus to help. And Jesus says, you give them something to eat. What do you see? What images come to your mind? Perhaps folks could open eyes and kind of come back into the group again. I wish we had much more time to spend on sharing those images and developing them, but would some people offer what images came to your mind in that meditation? Or what feelings came to you?
When the one woman brought up the food for the and then other people followed. Mm-hmm. For me, that particular moment moved me. I'm not, mm-hmm. I could probably know why, but I know it did move me. Mm-hmm. And for me to think about God just giving all this food doesn't move me in the least. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mm-hmm. matter. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It doesn't help me, and it mm-hmm. doesn't help the world. Mm-hmm. That does move me. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. That's more of a miracle to me. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. And it only goes to show exactly what you were saying previously. Mm-hmm. But as a person, you know, as a living mm-hmm. thing, you know, mm-hmm. that moves me. Hmm. And I don't know if I'm Christian, you know. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you
know, I don't know what that means, but I'm yeah. saying that yeah. I believe that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I hear you. You don't need to be Christian to believe that.
I think the thing that struck me, the way that they were one after the other, and then you had us move to our time and to be in the midst of marginalized people. Mm-hmm. The gift, it comes down to an individual kind of thing. It was like Jesus' disciples laid all out. I mean, mm-hmm. the seven loaves or whatever that they had mm-hmm. was what they had planned for their band to have over the next while. Well, they laid that all out at this mm-hmm. particular time. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, it's in the process of sharing all that we have, mm-hmm. Not in any long-range plan of attempting to change someone, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. but simply as an offer. Mm-hmm. And then in the midst of that, of doing what we can with the people that we know. I mean, mm-hmm. we find ourselves in a situation with 5,000 people. When Jesus found himself mm-hmm. in a situation with 5,000 people, mm-hmm. it wasn't that he was looking at something that was going to create so that these people would never be hungry again. Uh-huh. He dealt with the immediate uh-huh. need with the resources that he had, and he uh-huh. offered those resources. Uh-huh. And in response to that, and again, it's like what Marcus, I think what Marcus uh-huh. was talking about, it, uh-huh. it's not an issue of belief, it's an issue uh-huh. of relationship.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yes. Yes. It's a very hopeful comment, too, that you just made. It's much less daunting to think of that than massive change.
Yeah, we don't have yes. to cure world hunger. We just have yes. to the people that are right there for that day.
And in this story, some doing that did create a massive change in that situation.
Change is hard.
Yeah. I want to call you Iona, but that's not quite right, is it? Yes.
I took it one step further. I guess I started identifying with I thought of specific people. Uh-huh. And so I started identifying with what a gift of just... Mm-hmm. you know, something they need would do for them. And I saw them as giving them hope, as giving them a feeling that someone cares about me. Uh-huh. As a hopeful. Uh-huh. Not as a cure, uh-huh. but just as hope.
Good point. Yes. The hope that is produced by being the recipient of sharing, of gift, as well as the giver.
It struck me that one person could do many. So often we think, oh gosh, I'm one person. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. By my own self, really, uh-huh. there's not that much I can do. Uh-huh. And yet I think it's better that one person does something uh-huh. instead of nothing. Uh-huh. Because you, say I work with one person uh-huh. to help one person in uh-huh. some way. And maybe that person then is enabled to go and work with other people. Mm-hmm. And it's mm-hmm. kind of a ripple effect. And I'm never going to know what's happens mm-hmm. at the end. Mm-hmm. All I'm going to see mm-hmm. is that I've worked with one person, and I won't know beyond that.
Well, maybe that's similar to the idea of that we as disciples are called not to solve, but simply to walk the path. I had a friend who was an incredible activist, a Lutheran pastor in Seattle, who was always... enormously involved in, you know, protesting the nuclear Trident submarines, and he had 13 adopted children, many of them disabled. He baked bread every Saturday for this whole family. But in other words, his life was in many ways heavy. He was in prison much for resistance, for many civil disobedience, but he would always laugh. And, you know, I'm accustomed to kind of letting the heavies just heavy me down, and the oppression of the world heavy me down, but he was as aware as I've ever been, and he would laugh with this incredible bubbling laugh all the time. And one day I asked him, I said, John, how is it that you can keep on with all of this laughter given the realities that you dare to face? And he said, oh, Cindy, he laughed, I know the end of the story. And I loved that, and I've always loved that. And knowing the end of the story can be one thing that gives us the hope to do just our own, our one individual's effort, knowing that that won't change the world, but we do know the end of the story, and it will be part of the changing of the world, of building the new creation.
What's the end of the story?
Well, for him, in his mind, the end of the story was the reality of the presence of God, the infinite, incredible, loving, overwhelming presence of God with all people, and that, be it through whatever kind of miracle, the coming of God in the traditional sense or the people moving towards God in the sense that we've talked about in this story, but that in the end, right relationship would be established. Right relationship between people, right relationship between the people and the earth, right relationship between the people and God. And for some people that might mean, again, principally between people and all living things, but that right relationship would in the end be established. And my leaning, or this story's leaning, would be that that is the work of God and that is the work of the people walking the path of God, given the courage to do so by the love of God. I think that's what the end of the story meant to him. Maybe he would say it otherwise. That is the end of this story too, because we need to stick to a 1 hour framework. I thank you all, and I would also note that in tomorrow's session, Saturday, I need 7 readers to do a little bit of reading. So if you plan to be here for sure tomorrow, you might see me between now and then, so that you could do a brief, very brief reading. Again, also let me point out the terrific resources in the library, in the Resource Center here on the Quincentenary. The tape can end.